This episode is presented by Shaxbury Cider.
Hey, this is Hannah, HRN's program manager. It's HRN's 10th anniversary and now our summer fun drive. So show your support for independent, revolutionary, entertaining food radio by becoming a monthly recurring donor. HRN is powered by a passionate community of thoughtful eaters, and we need each and every one of you to show your support so that we can keep bringing you your favorite food podcasts. It takes a village, and every dollar donated, every listener tuning in is essential to our continued success. So set up a donation for $10 every month. You'll show us that you want to be a part of a bright future for HRN. And you'll get one of our brand new limited edition Pizza Pocket t-shirts. So snag your new favorite tea and show us some love, all for the price of about two fancy lattes each month. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate today. And thank you.
Hello, and welcome to A Hungry Society. I'm Korsha Wilson, and this is the show where we talk about food, food media, and so much more. Today's show is going to be an interview with someone I've wanted to have in the studio, on the show for a long time, and because of events this week, it seemed like it was the absolute perfect time to have this guest. Today we're going to be talking to Zella Palmer, who is an educator, food historian, author, and filmmaker, who serves as the chair and director of the Dillard University Ray Charles Program in African American Material Culture. Palmer is committed to preserving the legacy of African American and Latino culinary history in New Orleans and the South. Zella curated the first Story of New Orleans Creole Cooking, the Black Hand in the Pot Academic Conference, Nellie Murray Feast, and the Dr. Rudy Joseph Lombard Black Hand in the Pot Lecture Series. Zella, welcome to the show.
Hi, Korsha. Thanks for having me.
So, as I said in the intro, this past week we lost the incredible, amazing Chef Leah Chase. And so I really wanted to have someone on the program who could speak to her importance, not just in New Orleans and this country, but also personally. And mm-hmm. I can't think of anyone who, you know, really just lives, breathes New Orleans culinary history and Black culinary history in this country, like, as much as you. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
So first, let's talk about Chef Chase for a bit. This past week, I'm sure same for you, but I've been able to touch base with so many Black culinarians in this country. We're all kind of grieving, but also grateful that we got to witness a life like Chef Leah Chase. How has the week been for you?
It's been tough. I woke up in the middle of the night to my phone going off on Saturday, and Therese Nelson, who I know you know, runs the blog Black Culinary History. She said, "I'm sorry for your loss." And I'm thinking, what loss? I text her back. And then, you know, I looked and saw the other text, and it was Miss Leah. Mm. And, you know, I just broke down like a lot of us. And I thought about, you know, the family and just New Orleans. And, I mean, we all knew it was coming, but, you know, she's our queen, so, you know, you want the queen to live forever, you know? And it was tough. It was really tough. A lot of emotion, you know, and it's still processing it because, you know, the public funeral is tomorrow on Saturday, and mm-hmm. then the mass is on Monday, so.
Yeah. And her passing was covered by a lot of different outlets, but for listeners who maybe aren't as intimately familiar with the story as you are, can you kind of summarize the impact of Chef Chase?
Yeah. To me, and to a lot of other people, Miss Leah was New Orleans' oracle. She was our teacher. And I don't know how it would feel to go back and not see her sitting at her table in the kitchen and being able to go to her for guidance. She saw it all, 96 years. I can't imagine living 96 years and running a restaurant to the way that she did for 75 years and more. And the majority of New Orleans knew that, and they loved her and adored her on not just New Orleans, but all over the world. And every time you talk to her, you learn something new about New Orleans history, about Creole cuisine and culture, about marriage, about whatever was on her mind and whatever she wanted to talk to you about. And when she knew that you knew that she loved you, when she would fuss at you, or if she would send a special dish out from the kitchen for you to try, or you know, and even if she let you back in her kitchen, and she was just a special, special woman. I mean, she was everybody's grandmother. She was just the epitome of elegance and grace and just wisdom. And it's saddening because, you know, it's generations that's being lost. Not that long ago, a couple of years ago, New Orleans also lost Rudy Joseph Lombard. And the last time I saw him, he was, you know, dying of cancer, and he decided to have his repast while he was alive. And last time I saw him was in Dickie Stay's restaurant.
Wow.
We were all sitting around with all these civil rights legends. And here we were again, you know, in Dickie Chase restaurant, so much more than just a restaurant. It really was the meeting space for everyone from uptown New Orleans ladies to downtown, you know, Seventh Ward civil rights activists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you wrote this gorgeous essay that's it's titled A Love Letter to Leah Chase. And you talk about the first time that you met Chef Chase, and it was the 90s. I imagine you in like jeans and like a big tee and like some hoops. And Chef Chase was like, wear a dress.
It's funny, but I was, my god sister was at Xavier, and I was visiting for spring break. And you know, we went, she said, oh, we got to go to Dickie Chase restaurant, and we had our little chore money. And, you know, we went to eat, and that was the first time, and I had been at a restaurant like that in the middle of the hood, a fine dining restaurant. It kind of just really, you know, messed with my head for a second, and I had to say, is this really, you know, across the street from the project? And I walked in, you know, and just, and she, I felt awkward. I wanted to go back to the dorm and change because I felt like I was at my grandmother's house. Mm. And I talked about that in the article and just how that felt. And years later, I come back, and she always had a sharp memory. I mean, she remembered everything. And I was shocked that she remembered me. And she told me, you look good with the dress on. It's about time.
Yeah, she did not mince words. She let you know how she felt.
Exactly. She always did that. And it was, you know, she was an incredible woman. There's so many stories that so many people have. And I wanted in the article also to interview, you know, people from the neighborhood who knew her. And it was important for me to interview Vance Volkerson, who was third generation Seventh Ward Creole sausage maker, who supplied Charisse, which is a Creole hot sausage, for her gumbo. And his family supplied it for 75 years. That was important for him to also heal through this. So it was a group effort, and we just wanted to put something out there. And I'm grateful to the family mostly for their feedback and love from that from that article. And that they, you know, said, thank you. I appreciated that. And it made me cry because I literally, you know, as I wrote it, I prayed for her to guide me, you know, through what I was writing. And, you know, it's tough. It's tough. I feel like we've lost our grandmother in a way.
I think for me personally, whenever I think about her legacy, I think about the dignity of fine dining and her commitment to make sure that everyone had that opportunity. Like you said, you know, when you walked in for the first time, you were like, wait, this nice restaurant. It's like in the hood. Like, and I feel like so many people feel that way when you walk into that building. It's like going to church. It's like pictures everywhere of beautiful black artwork. And it's just like, it's this like temple of just like black excellence in New Orleans.
Absolutely. And she saw it all. I mean, can you imagine being there since 1941 and originally, you know, her in-laws having a sandwich shop and lottery, you know, just she saw so many changes in the neighborhood and, you know, Treme being diverse at one time where it was black and Sicilian and, you know, all these people that once lived there. And then, you know, during the crack epidemic and when, you know, when I went in before the storm, just seeing, you know, there's a lot of across the street, you know, it's about 900 people living in the project across the street. And then now seeing, you know, a resurgence of the Treme neighborhood, and now all of a sudden it's popular and the gentrification of it, it's deep. And she saw all of that, you know, and she fed everyone, you know, not just people nationwide who are famous, but people who are famous New Orleanian, you know, that mattered and had and did so much to make sure that we had integrated lunch counters and, you know, and laws passed so we can have a better New Orleans. So all of those people she fed.
So, I mean, I've wanted to have you on this show for a while to talk about your work as a historian. I think now might be a great time to ask you about how you see your work, because so much of your work is based in preserving these legacies for future generations. Mm-hmm. How do you approach that?
For me, I'm always thinking about how to engage young people and how do I disseminate research, stories, and living cultures so that it's passed down to each generation and that it reaches their hearts and minds to take action. For example, most recently, I took a group of students, a Ray Charles Program scholarship recipients, to a trail ride in Sulphur, Louisiana. If you're not familiar with a trail ride, it's been a legacy and tradition in Southwest Louisiana, the original Creole of color cowboys who come together and play Zydeco music, cook outdoors, and, you know, just ride horses throughout the entire city. It's like a, you know, a rural second line, basically. So one of my students, Levante, is a film major, and he's born and raised in New Orleans, but he had never been to any outside of New Orleans in Louisiana. And it's a funny story. He called his grandmother and he said, "Grandmother, you know about trail rides?" He said, "I'm at a trail ride." And she said, "Of course I do. It's about time you learned about trail rides." And he's also an amazing filmmaker and photographer. And I didn't have to tell him to go around and document and film people and interview people. He did it on his own. And he said, "Ms. Palmer, I'm going to expand my work outside of New Orleans and include the rest of Black Louisiana." So for me, it's project-based curriculum and expanding, and not just keeping my research to myself, giving students experiences and young people experiences. And that was really the vision of what Mr. Ray Charles, you know, had in mind, to make sure that students and young people are learning and that traditions are passed down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you've done... I mentioned a few of your projects in the intro, but it seems like your work is also like interdisciplinary. Like it's not just talks or readings, or it's actual, like, you know, bringing like people like Michael Twitty, Dr. Conyers, making sure that young people see these people as well, actively living these culinary histories.
Absolutely, and you know, food and culture is interdisciplinary. It's a thread that binds us. And so for me, bringing them to campus or, you know, taking them out into to see culture and to see that it's living and not just in some book you know, it's the whole purpose of what we're trying to do. You know, and we have students who are, you know, public health majors who aren't even Ray Charles, you know, scholarship recipients, but they're still involved. And I try to match whatever their major is, and for them to see that it's a correlation between food and culture and whatever they're doing. And they have to be ambassadors to carry it on.
How did you come to this work? What inspired you to take this on?
My parents. I have to say my parents. My parents were always activists and, you know, politicians in Chicago. And our house was what we would call the Palmer House South. And we had the whole world in our house. We had people staying in our house, you know, from all over. And the dinner table was just so special for us. And everyone was always in our kitchen cooking and, you know, sharing food and sharing history and politics and stories. And my mother was a former professor at Northwestern as well. So, you know, it was always intellectual conversation, stimulation, and food was always in the middle of that. And, you know, their collection, their art collection, their books, it became natural to me. And so when eventually, you know, I became the second chair director because Dr. Jessica B. Harris was the first. I knew that it was just my purpose and passion, and I was just excited to continue with the work that I already grew up with. Mm.
And so your work today is so much about, you know, you were on this great panel earlier this year at Resistance Served, and I saw you talk, and you were on the stage with Therese Nelson and Michael Twitty, and the panel was called Cultural Receipts. And it was so hard to avoid using that in the title for this show, because when I think about you and the work that you do, you are literally creating receipts for future generations to look at and say, oh, this is my history. This is my culture. This is the food that is in my bones, in my body, in my history. I'm curious what you want your students or the students that you work with, or even non-students who happen upon your work, what do you want those future generations to know?
That culture is living. And New Orleans is, you know, prime example of that. I mean, the culture that is in the homes, that's been passed down from generation to generation, spills out into the streets. You know, every Sunday, the second lines, Mardi Gras culture, and we have to preserve it. We have to preserve it because it's American culture. And for me, you know, we've, for so long in education, we've been siloed into, oh, you must be a science major, you must be a math major, and, you know, or you must be whatever kind of major, arts major. It's all connected. It's all connected. And I think, you know, when we look at just curriculum or, you know, from the past and HBCUs or even other universities, you know, I think they understood that everything is connected and it shouldn't just be for a certain class of people to have access to culture and, you know, and higher academic careers. It's because once you understand that a young person who becomes an adult, they need to be well-rounded. And the best way that we can do that is to expose them to as much as possible. Hmm.
So what are some ways that listeners can support your work at Dillard with the Ray Charles program?
Well, you know, we always love support through funding. you can go to www.dillard.edu and you'll find, you know, more information about us, or follow us on Instagram at Dillard_RayCharles or on Facebook as well and Twitter. And, you know, just be a part of it. if there's any suggestions or anything of that nature, mentorship, you know, internship, we will gladly, you know, reach out, appreciate the feedback and, you know, community outreach.
Awesome. So we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with more with Zella Palmer.
This episode is brought to you by Shaxbury Cider, who believe cider can be daring, complex, and eminently drinkable. Located in Vergennes, Vermont, Shaxbury make a broad offering of ciders, from the bright and fruity rosé to inventive small-batch wild apple fermentation. Each fall, Shaxbury takes to the hills of Vermont to forage for the wild and forgotten fruit that make up their Lost Apple Project. Shaxbury, producer of the first American-made Pet Nat cider, continues to experiment every year with limited edition ciders designed to spotlight locally foraged fruit. To learn more, visit Shaxbury.com or follow them on Instagram at Shaxbury.
I hope you're enjoying this podcast. And you know, Heritage Radio Network has thousands more. Hi, my name is Linda Palacio, and I'm the host on A Taste of the Past here on HRN. Join us on a weekly journey through culinary history where we explore the when, where, what, and why of food throughout history. You can find A Taste of the Past wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
All right, so we are back with Zella Palmer. And I know you mentioned growing up in Chicago and your house being called Palmer South. I'm wondering if you have any dining traditions that your family had growing up.
There always had to be good wine, of course. I had to wait until I was older.
You have to say that now.
You know, it was really organic. It was just love. I can remember, like I said, my mom's side of the family is from North Carolina. So they had their way of cooking. And then my dad's side of the family is from New Orleans and Mississippi. So, you know, it's interesting to see, you know, aunties and uncles get in the kitchen and people, you know, say what dish they were popular for and argue about it. And then it was also interesting because, you know, Chicago is really diverse. And my parents, like I said, were community activists. So we always had someone in the house from who needed help. And, you know, and we had so many people living with us, Cubans, Puerto Ricans, you know, Mexicans. And it was just, you know, it was always food in our house. And I can remember when my grandmother died, we didn't have time to cook the food, you know, and prepare for the repast. And, one of my extended aunts stepped up and she made Puerto Rican food. And so as much affection as I have for my parents' cuisine and my aunts and uncles, I also have the same respect for Latino cuisine and West African cuisine, specifically Nigerian, because those were my aunts and uncles as well.
That's so beautiful that you remember your like family table growing up as like this, like, melting pot is overused, but like you remember it as like this place where all kinds of people came together and brought food to nourish one another.
Absolutely. And you know, that's one of the, I think one of the beauties of Chicago. And, you know, people go to high school, you know, it's really diverse, you know, and then other cities, major cities are like that. So you end up eating each other's food, you know, and I think that is quite remarkable.
So, you know, we talked about going to Dickie Chase's when you were visiting your cousin Xavier. Are there other restaurant experiences that have shaped you in your career?
There's so many because my parents loved to eat out. You know, they loved to cook at home and they loved to eat out. So they showed me to really just the world and not to be a picky eater. They hated, you know, they didn't want me to become a picky eater because sometimes I would bring friends along and they, oh, I don't want to eat this. Oh, no. And, you know, but once they were open to, you know, coming and eating with us, they, you know, they liked it. And it made me feel happy as a kid and teenager to, you know, bring them along with me and my parents. So I have tons of restaurants that I adore across the nation. Some of my favorites in New Orleans are obviously Dookie Chase Restaurant, Moro's. There's a lot of them. Heard That Kitchen. There's so many that I love and adore.
I have heard so much about Heard That Kitchen, and I have not been.
You should go.
Okay.
You should go. Chef Jeff is an incredible chef, and it's another family-run business. And he was a server for 25 years in fine dining, so he is doing his best to, you know, put out fine dining in the hood again.
Oh, that's amazing. I have to do that the next time I'm in New Orleans.
You do.
Do you have a go-to order when you're there?
That's my favorite one, the Superdome. I love the Superdome. It's like this mountain of grilled fish with these sautéed potatoes and these crispy onion rings and this like crawfish sauce that's over it. It's incredible.
Oh, that sounds so good right now. Do you have any other favorite restaurants in other cities in America?
In Chicago, my favorite is, I have a couple of favorites. The Papas Cache Sabroso, it's on Division, and they make jibaritos, which is a Chicago Puerto Rican fried plantain sandwich. And it is, I mean, everybody in Chicago grows up eating that, you know, and it is my favorite spot for that. And then right near that in Logan Square is another restaurant. What's on the tip of my tongue? And they own like two or three. It's on Damon Avenue, and they have two restaurants. It's so popular that they had to open up another restaurant right across the street. And
wow.
They serve the best barbacoa tacos in the world to me. So, and then I have, you know, I have Nigerian restaurants. I love Yasa and Senegalese restaurant in Chicago and Hyde Park, which is really good. So those are my favorite kind of go-to restaurants. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the restaurants in Chicago, the soul food restaurants, have closed down. And that's like a whole nother conversation. But it's, you know, it goes back to generational wealth and us sometimes, you know, the older generations making sure that we went off to college, but then not necessarily making sure that the business was passed down. So Isola's, Gladys's, Army and Lou's, all those restaurants, soul food restaurants that I grew up eating in when I was a little girl are gone, you know. And those are places where Muhammad Ali, where all the greats, you know, ate when they came to Chicago.
Wow. That actually leads perfectly into my next question for you, which is, how have you seen New Orleans restaurant scene change over the years?
I have. Now I see much more Black ownership in restaurants, but it's growing, but it's still, you know, it's still not where it was, where it's where Austin Leslie, like the greats like Austin Leslie, Chef Austin Leslie was, and I think it's going to get to that. Right now it's kind of serving to-go plates, which is nothing wrong with that. I think one of the amazing stories that's come out of New Orleans is We Dat Kitchen. His name is Greg Tillery, and he has, you know, just signed a major deal with New Orleans Pelican to serve, you know, chicken. And he's doing incredible. And I remember literally like 3 years ago, him being on a food truck on Tulane Avenue and selling chicken out of a food truck right near the prison. So to see where he is now is incredible. And there's definitely a vegan movement going on in New Orleans, which was sorely needed, and people responding. And it's coming from our community and our neighborhoods because we want, you know, healthy food. You know, so you see Fruit Man on the corner, so, you know, selling his fruit. And then, you know, you see other chefs like Chef Ashe making incredible raw vegan food. And I think there was an article recently about three barbers who opened up a vegan restaurant. So it's it's rising, and I love to see, you know, what young chefs are doing now.
It also speaks to, you know, going back to the culinary history of Black people in this country, like, just it speaks to how food has always kind of been there and, like, been just this, not just like tool of nourishing one another, but also like a tool to create capital and create like ownership. And it's just been such a huge part of the community for, you know, a long time.
Absolutely. And in our documentary, when my students and I did our documentary that's up on YouTube, we got footage from the New Orleans Historic Collection of the vegetable men. You know, this was a viable job in New Orleans at the time, and really across the South, you know, and even in cities like Chicago. I mean, people were selling, you know, vegetables and fruits from door to door, and that is how they were able to make a living. You know, and it's, and when you see sometimes people out on the corner still selling food, I mean, that's just a tradition that just continues because people need residual income, you know, and the best way sometimes that they can do that is through food.
Absolutely. And I just want to let listeners know that the video on YouTube, you should absolutely go watch it. It's like the story in New Orleans. Specifically how African Americans have shaped the food of New Orleans and by proxy the entire country. So I highly recommend that you go and watch that if you haven't. I have some questions that I ask every guest that comes on the show. Can you talk about your worst dining experience? And you can name the place if you want to, but you don't have to.
Okay. Well, I remember when I went to, I won't name the name it, but when I went to a restaurant and my family and I were the only people of color in the restaurant, and the server really treated us inappropriately. Mm. And it's a lesson that I teach my students, and we have a Life After Dillard dining etiquette program where we teach students about, you know, how to dine in a dining room and in whatever dining room setting. And we learn it on campus and then we take them off campus. And this year we were able to take students to visit Chef Kristen Essig in New Orleans. And we had an incredible experience. And, you know, I just used that experience of what not to do and what to do. And it was unfortunate because, you know, the server got kind of loud because we wanted to split the check in two ways. And, you know.
Oh, wow. The server got loud?
Kind of just, you know, shamed us a way. And my cousin, you know, who was in town was, I mean, she's high, like a huge, big name person in D.C., you know, and she was just done. You know what I mean? And then maybe, you know, it bothered all of us, you know, and we just handled it as we saw fit. And then the chef knew who I came out and saw me and knew who I was and was embarrassed by it, you know.
Wow.
And I felt, you know, I'm glad that I handled it well and kind of like calmed my cousin down because she's the type of person who's like, you know, you should know my name when you come into the restaurant. And I'm not like that.
Oh, wow. That's, I mean, people have come on the show and talked about, you know, the level of service decreasing because of what they look like. But I haven't heard the story of a server getting loud with people at the table. It's more like they ignored us or, you know, didn't seat us or, you know, didn't want to talk to us.
She did it. I mean, it was on the sly. You know, she just made it so that everyone else in the restaurant that was around our table could hear that we were splitting the check.
Wow.
You know. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
I
hope you never went back.
Well, it's complicated. like I said, I know the chef.
Right.
You know, it's complicated. But, you know, I'm sure the server, I don't know if that server is still there, but I'm sure she was, you know, had a conversation with the chef.
So my last question for you, If you could have your last meal in a restaurant, where would it be and who is invited?
Well, it wouldn't be in a restaurant. It would be the Nellie Murray feast that we did in 2016. I absolutely adored that moment, and that was one of the highlights, that we were able to give Miss Leah Chase flowers while she was alive. A group of us women got together in New Orleans to put together a fundraising dinner that would raise money for her documentary. And it was the most fabulous event I've ever been to. And, you know, I'm not just saying that just because about six or seven of us women organized it, including, you know, Miss Leah's granddaughter, Tracy. But the food was incredible. And Miss Linda Green, she made a creamed oyster gumbo. And it was, we were bringing back 19th century Creole dishes. And that creamed oyster gumbo was the highlight of the night. And then Duke, who is Miss Leah's grandson, who owns the Duke's Place in New Orleans, Louis Armstrong Airport. Mm-hmm. And he trained in a French culinary school in France. The dishes that he was putting out that night was, I still can remember the taste of it. It was phenomenal. And then, of course, Chef Benjamin Dennis, BJ Dennis, in his stewed okra. I have never had okra like that before. So that would be my last meal, and just sitting there, you know, with good friends, and my mother was there and Miss Leah, that would be my last meal.
So just to back it up for listeners, Nellie Murray was a former slave who, it's been written that she was the Leah Chase of her day. But just legendary Creole chef. Do you want to elaborate a little bit on Nellie Murray's story?
Sure. Nellie Murray was, like you said, she was the Leah Chase of the 19th century. She was enslaved by the Hebert family, the 14th governor of Louisiana, and she was freed by de facto by the end of the Civil War, and she was able to take everything that she learned from her mother and grandmother, who were enslaved cooks on the plantation and serving the governor and all these, you know, high society people, and turn it into fame and fortune. Mm-hmm. And she ended up cooking for Susan B. Anthony at the Chicago World's Fair. There's an article of her in the Daily PQ in 1894 where she basically went, on a tour, European tour, and to Austria, to Belgium, to London, everywhere. And you have to think about 1894 and right. A Southern newspaper lifting this woman up and the chef up, and saying you are nobody if you don't know Nellie Murray. And, you know, she gives her opinion on European living. That was pretty profound.
Right. And if listeners, if you want your mouth to water, go to YouTube. There's a couple of videos of the Nellie Murray feast in 2016, and it looks so good. The food looks amazing.
Now you see why that would be my last meal.
Right. If this is the first time a guest has ever had like a YouTube video that could serve as the visual for their last meal. This is perfect. I could just direct people to YouTube to get a visual sense of it is that you want to go out to.
I know the Nellie Murray Feast Committee would love that. They would just be delighted that everyone, you know, saw what we did that night, because it was a special night. It was a special night. We had fun.
So what would you be drinking at your last meal?
Last meal. That's a good question. A good glass of red wine.
Mm.
I love red wine. I love Malbecs. That's one of my favorites. And a mojito.
Which one first?
probably the mojito to start. And then definitely a glass of Malbec to just top off the night.
That sounds fantastic. That's a good way to go. Zella, thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we got to do this proper and have you in the studio one day.
That would be awesome. Thank you.
And thank you so much for listening. We'll catch you next week on A Hungry Society.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebrations happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like. Tell your friends. And please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.